know what to say and just nodded. I wrote to his show when I was 7. Linda continued, I wanted him to fix it for me to visit the Disney studios and draw a cat for an animation film. You know, they make animations with loads of pictures drawn with tiny differences. I'm sure DCI Foster knows how animation works, said David, rolling his eyes at Erica conspiratorially. Of course, I never got a reply. Even Jimmy Savile rejected me. Linda laughed dryly. Jesus, can you just try and be normal for once? You come wearing that stupid jumper making 6 jokes, snapped David. Linda jumped as he slammed his empty glass on the table and walked away. It wasn't a joke. I really did want to visit the Disney studios, said Linda, blushing and twitching her hair off her forehead. Erica was glad when Colleen appeared and took her to the makeup girl. Marsh and Sparks were now standing near the door to the larger conference room with Simon and Diana. The makeup girl worked fast on Erica, and just as she finished, a young guy wearing earphones approached and said there were 2 minutes to go. Erica's phone rang. Sorry, I need your phone off. It interferes with the sound, he said. I'll just take this quickly, said Erica, seeing Moss's name flash. She moved over to the window and answered the call. Boss, it's me, Moss said. Are you there with the Super and Sparks? I've been trying their phones. They've switched them off, something to do with the microphones and sound, said Erica, realizing she'd been third on Moss's list. We've tracked down Marco Frost. He lives with his uncle in North London. Erica could see the press conference was about to start. Moss went on. Marco Frost was in Puglia in Italy until 2 days ago. He went with his uncle and aunt for an extended Christmas break to visit relatives. They drove in the uncle's car. The uncle owns a convenience store near Angel, and they brought back a shedload of olive oil and meats, etc., etc. So Marco Frost has an alibi, said Erica, the excitement rising in her. Yep, he even used his credit card when he was abroad. He can't have killed Andrea. Colleen appeared at Erica's elbow. We have to go, DCI Foster, and that has to be turned off, she said. Good work, Moss. Is it? This means we're none the wiser about who killed Andrea. Well, there's your theory. I've got to go, Moss. I'll talk to you later, said Erica, and hung up. She switched off her phone, and she saw the others move towards the conference room. Simon went first, followed by Marsh, then Sparks. So Marco Frost didn't kill Andrea, thought Erica. Sparks's theory has just fallen apart. The conversations she'd had with the glue pot barmaid and Ivy needled in her brain. Andrea had been seen with a dark-haired man and a blonde woman. They were still out there. Whoever did this was still out there. Marsh, Sparks and Simon had now disappeared into the press conference. Diana remained on the sofa. She was crying again and was being comforted by Linda and David. We need you in there now, hissed Colleen to Erica. Giles Osborne burst through the door at the back. He was rugged up in a huge winter coat. He rushed over to Diana, unwinding his scarf and apologising for being late. Have I missed the appeal? He said. Diana shook her head through her tears. No, DCA Foster, said Colleen. Erica made a decision which would have far-reaching consequences. She took a deep breath, smoothed down her hair, and went into the press conference. Chapter 26 Moss, Peterson, Crane and the rest of the team were back at Lewisham Row, gathered around a large flat-screen television. The BBC News channel counted down to the hourly bulletin, and then a wide shot of the press conference came onto the screen. Seated at the long table were DCI Sparks, DCI Foster and Superintendent Marsh. Next to Marsh sat Simon Douglas Brown, who looked haunted and drawn. Simon read his statement from the prepared script, and footage of him was interspersed with the driving licence photo of Andrea that had been doing the rounds in the press, plus a newer photo, Andrea on her last family holiday with Linda, David and their parents. They were all smiling at the camera with a backdrop of the sea behind. David smiled bashfully. Linda's face remained set in the same pudgy-faced scowl. DCI Foster was right. This is all very touching, said Crane. But it's like a well-packaged display of grief. Will it prompt anyone to call in? On the screen, Simon Douglas Brown finished his statement and the camera pulled out to a wide shot. Superintendent Marsh was about to speak when Erica leaned over and shifted his microphone towards her. She addressed the camera and started to speak. The events leading up to the disappearance of Andrea are confusing and we need your help. We would appreciate anyone coming forward who saw Andrea on the night of the 8th of January. It was a Thursday night. We believe Andrea spent some time between 8 p.m. and midnight in a pub called the Glue Pot on London Road, that's South London in Forest Hill. Andrea was seen by a member of the bar staff talking to a dark-haired man and a blonde-haired girl. Members of the public may also have seen Andrea walking up London Road between 8 p.m. and midnight towards the Horniman Museum where her body was found. If you have any information, however small, please come forward. Phone the incident room number, which will be coming up shortly.
Was that planned?
Asked Peterson, back in the incident room. Nope, said Moss. On screen, there was a moment where Superintendent Marsh couldn't find his place or what to say next. He shot Erica a look and pulled back the microphone.
We'd like to add that this is it's a lead that Andrea was seen. We also believe that Andrea could have been on her way to a party in the Rivoli Ballroom, which is close to Forest Hill Station, where she alighted on the night of the 8th of January,
countered Marsh more forcefully. There was a moment of silence. The camera cut again to a wide shot of the press conference.
Jeez, he's making a mess of it. It's like he's making it up, not Foster, said Moss.
The cameras flicked between wide shots of the conference room and the gathered press, which added to the confusion before settling back onto Superintendent Marsh, who finally got back on track and finished the scripted appeal. He ended with, "We have officers standing by now to answer your calls and emails. Thank you."
The camera then cut away from the press conference to the anchor in the BBC News studio. The screen behind her was filled with a contact number and email address for the incident room. She read out the details, asking again for anyone who had information, and repeating the name of both the Glue Pot and the Rivoli Ballroom, apologising that they only had a photo of the Rivoli Ballroom. The officers back in the incident room at Lewisham Row looked at each other uneasily, and then the phone started to ring.
Chapter 27. The moment the press conference disbanded and the live camera feed was off, Erica stood up. Her heart was pounding. The journalists and photographers were crowding towards the exits. Simon turned to Marsh, a furious look in his brown eyes.
"What were you lot fucking playing at?" he hissed. "I thought we were clear about this and how it would work."
He looked out almost despairingly at the press leaving. Marsh and Sparks stood up.
"DCI Foster a word now," said Marsh.
Erica took a deep breath and left the platform, ignoring their voices behind her as she crossed the carpet, speeding up towards the doors at the back of the conference room. Once through, she found a fire exit and clattered down three flights of stairs before bursting outside onto a side street. She stood and caught her breath, the rain pricking at her clammy skin. She knew there would be consequences for what she had just done, but didn't she always stand by her convictions? Her convictions had told her this was the right thing to do. She had done something good, something for Andrea, who didn't have the right to reply. She started to walk, not noticing the rain, and joined the bumping and jostling of the crowds on Oxford Street, lost in a cocoon of thoughts. Her gut feeling, the certainty she'd felt, began to fade. She should have stayed and faced the music. In her absence, they would be discussing what she had done, reaching conclusions. They were making decisions without her, planning what they would do next. She hesitated, then stopped. The rain pounded down on the pavements, and people streamed around her, their heads down, hoods and umbrellas up. They tutted and cursed as their smooth passage to the bus or tube was blocked. It was now the peak of rush hour. Erica needed to think, to plan what she would do next. If she went back, it would look weak. She set off again, moving with the crowd. Behind her, a few people back, followed a figure. The same figure that had watched Erica smoking at her window. This time the figure wasn't completely clad in black, but easily blended in amongst the crowd with their hoods and umbrellas. The crowd seemed to swell and slow as they approached Marble Arch Tube Station, the figure shadowing Erica with a gap of just two people between them.
Erica was one of the few people on the street without a hood and was walking with her head down, the collar of her leather jacket up. She is indeed a worry to me. She's been to that fucking pub and talked to people. She knows a great deal more than I thought. Has it been an act, all that angst and despair? Until that press conference, I thought she was damaged goods. The burnt-out wreck of a once brilliant cop. The figure was close to Erica now. All that separated them was a burly businessman in a pale raincoat mottled with drips of water. Erica pulled her collar closer, so that it touched the blonde hair at the nape of her neck. She's single and alone, grieving. She could be suicidal. So many people are. I'd love to pay her a call, the scrawny bitch. Surprise her in bed. Hold that skinny throat where the tendons bulge out and watch her eyes go dark. But there's someone else who is due a visit. The crowds reached Bond Street tube station and ground to a halt. Erica inched forward so she could just get under the large awning as she waited for the crowds to move forward. The figure edged closer, amongst the packed-in crowd, and slipped a neat white envelope into the pocket of Erica's leather jacket. Seconds later, the blockage at the station entrance cleared. The figure left Erica and moved on through the crowd, blending in, just another person eager to get somewhere fast.
Chapter 28. When Erica emerged from the concourse at Brockley Station, she was confused to see her new home in daylight. The street was busy. A Royal Mail van moved past and parked at a postbox. A fresh-faced young postman got out and opened the box, pulling out a full sack of letters. There was a cafe opposite the station, where two women sat at a table outside, huddled in jackets against the cold and smoking cigarettes. Thick red lipstick smeared on the edge of their white china cups. A handsome waiter with a pierced lip came to their table. He said something as he took their empties, and the women shrieked with laughter. Erica fumbled in her bag and pulled out her cigarettes. Her hands shook as she lit up. Her feeling of anxiety had increased during the train journey back. Her heart was pounding in her chest, and it was like she was seeing the world through slightly blurred glass. The handsome waiter was still chatting to the women, and they were flirting back with ease.
"Ah, no," said a voice.
Erica looked round. A paunchy man in a Southwest Trains uniform stood beside her. He had grey hair and a greying moustache.
"Excuse me?" asked Erica.
"You just quite fancy a £1,000 fine, do you, love?"
"What?"
she said, feeling dizzy.
"It's illegal to smoke at train stations, but I know how we can resolve this. All you need to do is take one step forward. Go on."
Erica, confused, stepped forward.
"There, love, all solved. You're no longer on station property."
He pointed to her feet, where she now stood on the smooth tarmac running past the station concourse.
"Okay," she said uneasily.
The man regarded her warily. It was only then that she realized he was being kind, but it was too late, and he went off muttering. Erica stumbled away, heart racing faster, drawing on her cigarette. The women at the cafe were now browsing the wine list, laughing and chatting with the handsome waiter. An old man twirled a metal stand of greeting cards around, outside a newsagent's on the corner.
Two old ladies walked slowly, weighed down by shopping bags and deep in conversation.
Erica grabbed the low wall outside a house and steadied herself. It occurred to her that she had no clue how to be a normal person. She could look at dead bodies and deal with interviewing violent sex offenders. She'd been spat at and threatened with a knife. But living in the real world as a member of society, it frightened her. She had no clue how to be single, alone, with no friends. The enormity of what she had just done came back to her. She'd hijacked the press conference of a major murder inquiry. What if she was wrong? She hurried back to the flat, the dizziness intensifying, a cold sweat prickling under her collar. When she was indoors, she slumped into the sofa. The room was spinning, and a fuzzy blur was creeping into the side of her vision. She blinked, looking round the small living room, The blur moved with her vision. She felt her stomach contract and she ran to the bathroom, only just making it as she threw up in the toilet. She kneeled and retched and threw up again. She flushed and washed her mouth out in the sink, having to hold on to its sides as the floor seemed to lurch and sway underneath. The reflection staring back at her was gruesome, sunken eyes, her skin tinged white-green. The blurry patches were growing, spreading in the centre of her vision. Her face was now a blur in the mirror. What was happening to her? She staggered back through to the living room, holding onto the wall, the door frame, then making a dash for the edge of the sofa. The centre of her vision was now flooded with a blur. She tilted her head, having to use her peripheral vision to locate her leather jacket half hanging over the armrest. She found her phone in one of the pockets, and tilting her head, she saw it was still switched off from the press conference. Blood roared in her head and nausea and pain rose in her. She was dying. She was going to die alone. She found the button on the top of her phone and switched it on, but a spinning disc on the screen told her it was booting up. She slumped forward, face on the sofa. She was terrified. A powerful headache was forming at the back of her skull. She realized that this could be the start of a migraine, just as the room seemed to give an almighty spin, and then everything went black. Chapter 29. Erica felt she was moving through darkness, fumbling towards a far-off ringing. It seemed to move closer and then her ears popped and it was close to her head. The side of her face was pressed against something soft, with a faint smell of fried food and cigarettes. Her knees were against a hard wooden floor. She sat back on her heels and lifted her head, realizing she was in her new flat. Her phone was ringing. It was dark outside, and the streetlight was shining through the bare window. The phone glowed and vibrated on the coffee table and fell silent. Her mouth was dry, and she had a terrible headache. She pulled herself up unsteadily and went to the sink and drank a large glass of water. She put the glass down, and it all came flooding back. One glimmer of hope was that her vision had returned to normal. Her phone rang again, and thinking it was Marsh, she answered, wanting to get it over and done with. A familiar voice said, "Erica, is that you?" She bit back tears. It was Mark's father, Edward. She'd forgotten how much he sounded like Mark, with his warm Yorkshire accent. "Yes, it's me," she said finally. "I know it's been a long time. Well, I phoned to say I'm sorry," he said. "Why are you sorry?" "I said things I regret." "You had every right, Edward. I can't bear to look at myself half the time." Her diaphragm lurched and she was sobbing, hiccuping, the words coming out in a jumble as she tried to tell the man who she'd loved like another father how sorry she was that she had failed to protect his son. "Erica, love, it wasn't your fault. I read a copy of the transcript from the hearing," he said.
"How?"
"I requested it, Freedom of Information Act. They hauled you across the calls."
"I deserved it. I should have dug deeper. Could have triple-checked things," she started.
"You can't live your life by should and could, Erica."
"I will never forgive myself. If only I could go back again. If only. I would never," she said, wiping hot tears away with the heel of her hand.
"Now, that's enough of that. I don't want to hear another word, or they'll be held to pay," he joked. The joke felt forced. There was a silence.
"How are you?"
Erica asked. Stupid question, she thought. "Oh, I'm keeping busy. I'm playing bowls now. Never thought I would, but, well, you have to keep busy. I'm a mean bowler for an old duffer." He trailed off again. "Erica, love, there's now a gravestone. I've had the stone put in for Mark. It looks grand."
"It does," said Erica. She closed her eyes. She thought of Mark underground and morbidly wanted to know what he looked like. Just bones. Bones in a nice suit.
"And you are welcome to come and see it. You're welcome any time, love. When do you think you'll be coming home?"
Home. He called it home. Erica had no clue where home was anymore.
I'm back at work. I'm in London, said Erica.
Oh, right.
I will come, but right now I have to work.
That's good, love.
What work are you doing?
He asked.
Erica felt she couldn't tell him she was hunting a brutal killer. She wondered if he had seen the press conference on the news. I'm with the Met Police, a new team.
That's good, lass. Keep yourself busy. When you get some holiday, I'd love to see you.
I'd like that.
I go past your house a lot. There's a young couple renting it. They seem nice, although I haven't been and knocked on the door or nothing. Not sure how I'd explain who I was.
Edward, everything is in storage. I didn't throw anything away. We should go through the boxes. I'm sure there are things...
Let's take it one step at a time, said Edward.
How did you get my new number?
Asked Erica, realizing she was on her new phone. I phoned your sister. She said you'd been kipping on her sofa. She gave me your number.
I hope that's okay.
Of course it is. Sorry, it's just the copper in me always wanting to work things out. I just want you to know, Erica, that you're not alone. I know people weren't kind up here, and you can't blame most of them. But you lost him too. Edward's voice cracked. He went on, I just hate to think of you being alone. You've got me, love, for what it's worth.
Thank you, said Erica softly.
Well, this'll be costing me a fortune ringing up London, so I'll be off.
It's good to hear your voice, Erica.
Don't be a stranger.
You too, I mean, no, I won't.
There was a click and a beep, and he was gone. Erica put her hand on her chest and took a deep breath. A rush of warmth flooded through her, and she had to blink back the tears. Her phone rang again in her hand. She saw it was Moss.
Boss, where are you?
She said.
Home. You're not going to believe this. Another body has been discovered, this time in the water at Brockwell Park.
Is there an ID on the victim? Asked Erica.
Yes, it's Ivy Norris.
Chapter 30. The Brockwell Park and Lido in Dulwich were less than 3 miles from the Horniman Museum, where they'd discovered Andrea's body. Erica hurtled past the clock tower, which was lit up and showing it was 10:15. Large drops of rain burst on the windscreen and rapidly became a downpour. Erica flicked on the wipers and leaned forward to see through the whirling water. 2 uniformed officers swam into view, standing beside a cordon at the Lido entrance. Erica came to a lurching stop and emerged into the rain, which was roaring as it hit the surrounding parked cars.
DCI Foster,
shouted Erica above the noise and holding up her ID. The officers lifted the tape and she passed through. The park and Lido were popular in the summer for swimming and picnics. But in the darkness of a rain-lashed January night, they were bleak and depressing. Moss and Peterson were waved through the police tape just behind Erica, bringing a powerful torch, its beam illuminating their way along a series of concrete paths, past a boarded-up ice cream hut and a pavilion with its paint peeling away. They emerged into a clearing, unable to make out anything. Thunder rumbled in the distance, and lightning lit up the vast open-air swimming pond. Up ahead was the glowing outline of a large white forensics tent. A path of polythene had been marked out along the muddy water's edge. 3 crime scene assistants in white overalls were kneeling in the mud, working fast to take an impression of a set of footprints. A crime scene officer met them at the tent, and they quickly suited up as the rain continued to roar on the canvas. A bright halogen light shone down on the still form of Ivy Norris. She lay on her back in the mud, amongst a churned-up mess of brown smearing her clothes and body.
"Please stand on the boxes," said a CSI, indicating where a series of platforms had been placed around the body to preserve evidence in the mud underneath.
They approached Ivy's body, moving from platform to platform until they were at her side. Her greasy hair was pulled back from her yellowing face, and her face was frozen in the same wide-eyed fear as Andrea. Her nose had been flattened amongst a mess of clotted blood. She wore the coat and jumper Erica had seen her in a few days previously, but she was naked from the waist down. Her legs were painful to look at, emaciated,
with clusters of scars, bruises and needle marks. Her pubic hair was grey and matted. A crime scene photographer took a picture, and the tent was filled with a flash and a high-pitched squeal. Isaac Strong stood silently on one of the boxes. He nodded at them all. "Who found her?" asked Erica. "A group of kids who climbed the fence for a dare." "Where are they now?" "Your officers are with them at the community centre over the road. We've already taken DNA." "Did they see anything?" asked Erica. "No, it was dark. One of the boys tripped over the body and fell."
"He must have been terrified," said Moss, looking down at Ivy.
"Her nose is broken, I think her cheekbone also. There are extensive ligature marks on her neck," said Isaac, crouching down and gently pulling down the folds of Ivy's sweater. "I also think four ribs are broken. I'll have more idea about internal damage when I conduct my autopsy." She was carrying £100 in cash. The notes were folded inside her bra.
"So we could rule this out as a random assault or robbery?" asked Moss.
"I don't want to be drawn on that until I've done my autopsy, but obviously when a body is left with money, it indicates that robbery wasn't on the assailant's mind. Sex was, though. On a first examination, there is semen present in her vagina."
"Ivy was a well-known prostitute," explained Moss.
"Perhaps whoever did this had lured her with the cash," added Peterson.
"We can't assume that because of that, that the sex was consensual," said Isaac sternly.
"There is extensive bruising around the pelvic area."
"Where are her arms?"
Erica asked, dreading for a moment that they'd been hacked off.
"Her arms are bound behind her back," said Isaac. One of his assistants approached and carefully lifted Ivy from the mud. Both arms had been pulled tight under her body. They were slick with mud and stones. Isaac wiped at her wrists with a gloved finger. "See? They've been bound using a plastic tie, often used in industry or product packaging."
"What about her shoes?" asked Erica, seeing Ivy's feet, which were mud-splattered and swollen with a map of broken veins and long, dirty toenails.
"We found them in the mud," said Isaac. "There are also patches of hair missing from each temple. They look to have been pulled out at the root."
He tilted Ivy's head and indicated large, angry pink patches dotted with dried blood. The photographer crouched in and took a photo. As the flash illuminated her skin, it appeared almost translucent, with threads of blue veins on her forehead.
"Andrea's hair was pulled out," said Erica softly.
"Time of death?" asked Peterson. "Internal body temperature leads me to say she hasn't been dead for very long, but the body has been exposed to the freezing temperatures and rain, so I'll need to clarify this."
"We've got officers doing a door-to-door and searching the area," said Peterson.
They watched as the photographer worked, taking pictures of Ivy from every angle. A young woman assisting Isaac gently placed plastic bags over Ivy's hands to preserve any DNA evidence. Isaac moved to a hastily set up bench in the corner of the tent, returning to them with a clear evidence bag.
"This is what we found on her. A bunch of keys, 6 condoms, £100 in cash, a credit card in the name of Matthew Stevens, and a phone number on a scrap of paper."
"That's your number," said Moss, shooting Erica a look.
"I was talking to Ivy the other night in connection to Andrea's murder. She had given me some information, but I think she was scared. I said she could call me."
Erica's voice tailed off with a realization that the information had died with Ivy.
"Did she try to call you?"
asked Peterson.
"I don't know. I'll need to check my phone."
She hadn't checked her messages since before the press conference. She excused herself and went back through the partition into the doorway of the tent. A figure was working its way along the bank. When it came closer, Erica saw it was DCI Sparks.
"What are you doing here?" asked Erica. "You're not in the first response unit."
"I've been asked by Chief Superintendent Marsh to take over as senior investigating officer," said Sparks.
Despite the gravity of the situation, his glee was bubbling under the surface.
"What, at 11 p.m. at the scene of a murder?" asked Erica.
"You should answer your phone. The super has been trying to call you," said Sparks.
"I haven't finished here. I can discuss this with Marsh tomorrow," said Erica.
"I have clear instructions. I've been made SIO, and I would like you to leave the scene."
You'd like me to leave?
No, I'm ordering you to leave.
DCI Sparks, I have just been to the crime scene and there are things...
started Erica.
I said I'm now in control of this crime scene and I'm ordering you to step aside,
shouted Sparks, losing it. I think you'll find, if you have any knowledge of crime scene procedure, that the forensic pathologist has ultimate control over the crime scene and therefore gives the orders,
said Isaac, appearing behind Erica with Moss and Peterson.
DCI Foster entered the crime scene as SIO, and I will finish my briefing and examination of the crime scene with her present as SIO. Now, DCI Sparks, you are in danger of contaminating the crime scene. If you wish to continue to observe, I'll ask that you follow proper procedure. Suit up and shut up.
DCI Sparks opened his mouth to say something, but Isaac looked down on him and raised an impeccably shaped eyebrow, daring him to contradict.
8 a.m. tomorrow there will be a briefing at Lewisham Row where we'll be refocusing this investigation. Be sure you attend promptly, said Sparks to Moss and Peterson.
They nodded. Sparks gave Erica a long, hard look, and then stomped away, accompanied by one of the uniformed officers.
Thank you, said Erica to Isaac. I didn't do it to be thanked. I'm not interested in police politics. All I'm interested in is preserving a scene so you can do your job and find out who did this, said Isaac.
Erica removed her crime scene overalls, which were bagged up to go to the lab. She found shelter from the pouring rain under the peeling facade of the pavilion, lit a cigarette, and listened to her voicemails. There were four from Marsh, all growing increasingly angry. Simon and Diana Douglas Brown had apparently been horrified when Erica had hijacked the press appeal for her own agenda, and Marsh was in agreement. He was ordering her to report to him immediately in the morning. The message finished with him saying,
"Ignoring my calls will be seen as a further act of insubordination and a direct challenge to my authority."
When she reached the final message in her mailbox, it began with lots of distortion. She heard a voice swearing, and then the sound of coins dropping into a payphone.
"Yeah, it's Ivy, Ivy Norris. If you can give me some money, I'll tell you what you need to know. I need 100 quid.
There were 3 fast pips, more swearing, and then the line went dead. Erica listened to the message again. It was timed 7 hours ago. Erica put in a call to Sergeant Crane, who answered wearily.
"Hi, Crane, it's DCI Foster. Are you still at the Nick?"
"Yes, boss," he said wearily.
"What was the response like to the appeal?"
"We've had 25 calls, boss. They died off over the last few hours. We're just waiting to see if they run the number again on the evening news."
"Tell me we've got something useful," asked Erica hopefully.
14 of them are known nutters and time wasters. They tend to admit to every television crime appeal. One of these guys still maintains that he killed Princess Diana. We still have to go through and eliminate them all, which is taking time. Another 10 calls have been from journalists, fishing basically."
"I make that 24.
"The last one was from Ivy Norris. She called a couple of hours after the appeal went out. We traced the call to a payphone at the Crown Public House. She was fairly incoherent but left her name and said she wanted to talk to you personally. Did you check your messages? I tried to call you but there was no answer."
"Yes, and she tried to call me too. We've just discovered her body."
"Shit," said Crane.
"Yes, shit indeed.
Look, I'll be in first thing tomorrow. Let me know if you get anything more. Boss."
"What?"
"I've been told to give all new info to DCI Sparks."
"Okay, but the Ivy thing, it's kind of personal too."
"'Course, boss."
Erica came off the phone as Moss and Peterson approached. She told them about the message from Ivy.
"She's cried wolf so many times before," said Moss, "and it was only a matter of time before she turned up dead."
"They're about to move the body. The team needs to close down the site for forensics as fast as they can. They're going to have to work fast in this rain," said Peterson.
"I take it we report to DCI Sparks?"
"Yes, it seems so," said Erica.
There was a moment of silence. Peterson and Moss seemed disappointed.
"Well, I'll see you both soon then," said Erica.
When she got back to her car, she sat inside in the darkness, the rain pummeling on the roof. Moss and Peterson drove past, illuminating the inside of her car, before plunging her back into darkness. The death of Ivy felt nasty. She pulled her hand out of the coat and flicked on the light above the mirror. The teeth marks were now fading, the scabs healing fast. What had Ivy been doing? Was she lured out to the Brockwell Lido? Did she go willingly? And what would happen to her grandchildren now she was gone? Erica started her car and pulled out into the rain. Chapter 31. The figure leant forward, yanking off the thick balaclava, and threw up violently. The vomit hit the inky water with a nasty high-pitched splatter, even louder than the rain, which was falling onto the surface of the pond in torrents. It was normal to purge after a kill. The figure then collapsed onto the wet earth, enjoying the sensation of the rain. It had been easy tracking down Ivy Norris. At her age, she was a creature of habit, and had been lurking under a streetlight at the bottom of Catford High Street. She'd looked more disgusting than usual, with what smelt like dried vomit on the furry hood of her coat and blood crusting around her nostrils. "My name's Paulette. You want oral or full sex?" Ivy had said, her eyes lighting up when the expensive car had pulled up beside her. She only saw the figure properly when she climbed into the passenger side, and the central locking was activated. "Hello, Ivy. I'm looking for something from you," the figure had said in a smooth voice. Ivy had started to plead and panic, apologizing, saying it wouldn't happen again, the words tumbling out, spittle flying onto the dashboard of the expensive car. "I'm telling you, I had to speak to that copper. She threatened me. She threatened to take me kids away. All she knows is that Andrea girl was with a bloke with dark hair and a girl with blonde hair, and I ain't gonna say no more." The figure had then held out a gloved hand, offering Ivy two £50 notes.
"What do you want me to do?"
Ivy had asked uncertainly. I don't know if she was just so beaten down by life, or if she thought there was a chance I would let her go afterwards.
But she took the money.
Ivy hadn't questioned the remoteness of the location, and when they had got there, she had allowed her hands to be tied behind her back. She hadn't even suggested a safe word.
"Just not me face," she said. "I know I'm not much to look at, but it makes life easier if it's not me face."
It was then that I snapped and punched her in the face. She didn't look surprised, just disappointed. When I did it again, harder, she looked consigned to her fate. Another disappointment to add to her collection. I ripped handfuls of her hair out, broke her nose. She only looked surprised when my hands had been on her throat for longer than a minute. It was then that she realized she was going to die. Far away, across the grass of Peckham Rye Common, a police car streaked past, sirens blazing out. The figure lay deep in the undergrowth next to a pond, enjoying the sensation of being cleansed by the rain. My car is a few blocks away, but I can't go back for it yet. Not yet, when it gets light, when I'm clean. Chapter 32. Erica didn't sleep for a long time. She lay awake, listening to the rain pounding relentlessly against the window. She couldn't get the image of Ivy out of her mind, of her blank eyes wide with horror, as if still seeing her killer's face. Erica wondered what that face looked like. Was it old or young, dark or fair? Was the killer physically threatening or an everyman who just blended in? She didn't remember drifting off to sleep. She opened her eyes and the light was filtering softly through the curtains in her bedroom. The day had dawned, and for the first time since she could remember, it had been a dreamless sleep. She pulled the curtain to one side and saw it had stopped raining, but the sky was a pale grey. It was light. She leaned over to the bedside table and picked up her phone to see the time. It was on its charger, but dead. She cursed, moving through to the living room where she saw the digital clock on the oven was dark. She opened up the tiny cupboard housing the electricity box, yanked out Marcy's blotchy painting, and flicked the main switch on and off. But nothing. Peering out of the front bay window at the empty street below, she had no clue what the time was. She opened her front door, crossed the landing to the door opposite and knocked. A few seconds later, she heard a key turning, bolts shooting back and the rattle of a chain. The door opened a few inches and a small elderly lady with a meringue of white hair peered through the gap.
"Sorry to bother you," said Erica. "Could you tell me what the time is?"
"Who are you? Why do you want to know the time?" the lady asked suspiciously. "I'm your new neighbour. I think we've had a power cut, and my only clock is on my phone, which is also dead."
The old lady pulled back the thin sleeve of her cardigan and peered at a tiny gold watch biting into the flesh of her wrist.
"It's 10:20 past, she said.
10:20 in the morning?
Yes.
"You sure?"
said Erica in horror.
"Yes, dear, I'm the one with the watch. My electricity seems to be working," she said, flicking her hall light on and off.
"I think you need to feed your meter, dear. The tenants before you got very behind on their bills. The police even came in at one point. I don't know why the police were wasting their time chasing up unpaid bills, although your landlord is apparently quite a high-up policeman, so I'd be careful."
Erica arrived breathlessly at Lewisham Row Station at 10:45. Wolf was on the front desk. He crossed round to her side.
"DCI Foster, I've been asked to take you in to see Chief Superintendent Marsh. It's urgent."
"I know where it is," snapped Erica. She went through to Marsh's office and knocked. Marsh opened the door.
"Come in and sit down," he said coldly.
Assistant Commissioner Oakley sat in Marsh's chair.
Marsh had been relegated to a chair beside his own desk. His office had been hastily tidied. The corner of a Christmas card poked out from one of the cupboard doors.
"Good morning, DCI Foster. Please have a seat," said Oakley,
in calm, clipped tones. He was immaculately dressed. His uniform crisp, his grey hair neatly parted, not a hair out of place. His skin was tanned and shiny. He was like a sleek fox. Not in any way sexual, but cunning and immaculately groomed. Erica remembered she'd read that if foxes are fed on the finest food, they have the glossiest coats. Erica sat and noticed that Marsh was pulling on a pair of latex gloves.
"Please can we see your mobile telephone?" said Oakley.
"Why?"
"You are the last person to have received a call from the murder victim, Ivy Norris. The voicemail on your phone is now evidence in the investigation."
His tone was final. No questions were to be asked. Erica took out the phone and handed it to Marsh.
"It's not switching on,"
said Marsh, turning the phone over and pressing the power button. "The battery's dead," said Erica.
"This is your designated phone, for work purposes, and it's dead?" asked Oakley.
"I can explain."
"Please read out the serial number,"
said Oakley, ignoring Erica. Marsh worked quickly, pulling the back off the phone and reading the number out as Oakley wrote it down.
"It's possible to access my voicemail independently without needing the handset," said Erica,
as Marsh placed her phone into a fresh plastic evidence bag and sealed it up. Oakley ignored her and opened a file.
"DCI Foster, do you know why you are here?"
"I think so, sir. I'm not sure why you are, though."
3 days ago, an official report was filed by Desk Sergeant Wolfe. It details an incident between yourself and Ivy Norris's 7-year-old grandson, Matthew Paulson. Ivy Norris, whose body was discovered last night."
"I'm aware of that, sir. I was one of the first responders at the scene," said Erica.
"It says in Wolfe's report that during the incident in the reception area of this station, you physically struck the boy on the back of his head. What do you have to say about that?"
The Assistant Commissioner looked up at her from the file.
"Is it also mentioned in the report that at the time the boy had latched onto my hand with his teeth?"
said Erica.
"What were you doing in such close proximity to the child?"
"He was sitting on my suitcase, sir. He wouldn't get off."
"He was sitting on your suitcase," repeated Oakley, leaning back.
He tapped his pen against his teeth.
"Were you injured during this attack by a small 7-year-old boy?"
"Yes, my hand was cut," said Erica.
"Yet there is no further entry to this incident in the report. Procedure would dictate that you are examined by a doctor who can verify this. Were you examined by a doctor?"
"No."
"And why not?"
It wasn't life-threatening. Unlike some people, I like to engage more in police work than pushing paper around. Not life-threatening. Yet these things can fast become career-threatening, said Oakley.
Erica looked to Marsh, but he said nothing. Oakley flicked through the file.
I had CCTV images pulled from the reception area, which does indeed show the full altercation. Ivy Norris threatened you with a knife, and the situation was diffused by the desk sergeant. However, 6 minutes later, you are seen in the car park where Ivy Norris and her 3 grandchildren get into your car.
He passed a large photo across the desk that showed a remarkably sharp image of Ivy and the children outside Erica's car. The next image showed Erica holding something out through the open window, and the next was of Ivy and the children climbing into Erica's car. It was freezing cold. I felt sorry for them. I gave them a lift.
And what were you holding out to Ivy in the photo?
Cash.
You gave them a lift?
Where?
To Catford High Street.
And then what happened?
I dropped them where they wanted to go.
Which was?
By a Ladbrokes betting shop. Ivy didn't want me to see where she lived. They left the car and vanished in between the shops.
Left the car or fled the car?
What happened when they were in your car? Was there any further physical violence from either party?
No.
You were then seen again, 24 hours later with Ivy Norris, this time harassing her at a private wake.
It was a glorified lock-in, sir, and Ivy was in a public place. I wasn't harassing her.
Did you know the landlord of the Crown filed an official complaint about police harassment?
Did he?
Was that in between working as a police informant, or was that part of his work as a police informant?
I would tread very lightly here, DCI Foster, said Oakley icily. These allegations are stacking up in quite an alarming fashion. Your phone number was found at the crime scene on Ivy Norris's body, plus she was found with £100 in cash. You are in this photo giving her cash.
I gave her my number and asked if she could call me with any information.
We have a transcript of the voicemail she left on your phone where she states, I quote, "If you can give me money, I'll tell you what you need to know. 100 minimum should do."
Hang on. You've already pulled my private phone messages. Are you suggesting I murdered Ivy Norris?
Erica looked at Marsh, who had the decency to look away.
No, we are not suggesting you murdered Ivy Norris, DCI Foster. Looking at this evidence, though, it's building a picture of an officer who is, frankly, a concern, perhaps a little out of control, said Oakley.
Sir, you all know we have our narcs. Our informants, who we take for a drink and a chat, a little money and a little information changes hands, but I did not give Ivy Norris £100.
DCI Foster, can I remind you that it's not official police policy to pay for information? Said Marsh, finally speaking up.
Erica laughed at this ludicrous statement.
Marsh's voice went up an octave. You also directly defied my orders with regards to the official statement we made at the press appeal. You jumped in. Unapproved, unscripted, used it as a mouthpiece for a wild hunch. Who knows what damage you have done?
Hunch? Sir, I have a strong lead on a man who was seen with Andrea Douglas Brown just hours before she was killed, and this was witnessed by a barmaid and Ivy Norris.
Yes, the barmaid who doesn't seem to exist, and an unreliable witness who is now dead, said Assistant Commissioner Oakley, remaining irritatingly calm. He went on, "Do you have an agenda against Lord Douglas Brown?"
"No."
"His role supplying defence contracts has been controversial and has impacted policy in all departments of the police and armed forces."
"Sir, my only agenda is to catch the killer of Andrea Douglas Brown and Ivy Norris. Am I going to be the first who says that the circumstances are remarkably similar?"
"So now you believe that the murders are linked?" said Assistant Commissioner.
"Can I just add, sir, that this is not the line of inquiry we are pursuing?" said Marsh spinelessly.
Erica paused. "Yes, I believe these murders are linked. I believe to pursue my line of investigation would be in the best interests of catching this killer."
"I repeat, this is not the line of inquiry we are pursuing,"
said Marsh.
Then what line of inquiry are we pursuing? Asked Erica,
fixing Marsh with a stare.
DCI Sparks had a prime suspect for all of 3 hours before he came back with an alibi.
You would know, DCI Foster, if you had bothered to attend the briefing this morning at 8, Marsh said.
I had a power cut at home and my phone wasn't charged, so I didn't have access to any messages or alerts. You will know from my records that this has never happened before.
There was a silence. How are you, in yourself, DCI Foster? Asked Assistant Commissioner Oakley.
I'm fine. How is that relevant? Asked Erica.
The past 3 months you experienced would have been stressful for anyone. You lead a team of 12 officers on a drug raid in Rochdale. Only 7 of you came back.
I don't need you to read my own file back to me, said Erica.
Oakley went on. You went in with insufficient intelligence. It seemed you were keen to get on with it, like you are now. Can you see how this might be construed as impulsive behaviour on your part?
Erica gripped the arms of her chair. She was trying to remain calm. The Assistant Commissioner continued.
5 officers died that day, including, tragically, your husband, D.I. Mark Foster. You were subsequently suspended. It seems you had the chance to learn a valuable lesson, but you didn't, and...
Erica found herself out of her chair, leaning over the desk and grabbing the file. She tore it in two and threw it back on the desk.
This is bullshit. I took the lead yesterday because I believe Andrea was seen with 2 people who could provide information about her killer. Simon Douglas Brown didn't like it, and he's now dictating how this investigation should be run.
She remained standing, in shock.
Assistant Commissioner Oakley sat forward in his chair and said in a practiced tone, DCI Foster, I am formally relieving you of duty, pending an investigation into your conduct and a fresh psychiatric evaluation of your ability to serve in the Police Force of England and Wales. You will surrender any weapons, formal identification and official vehicles and await further correspondence. You will continue to receive full pay pending results of our investigation, and you will present yourself when requested to be examined by an official police psychiatrist.
Erica bit down hard on the inside of her cheek, willing herself not to say any more. She handed over her ID badge.
All I want to do is catch that killer. It seems you both have another agenda.
She turned and left the room. Wolf was waiting outside with 2 uniformed officers.
I'm sorry. We have to see you out, he said, his jowly face hanging guiltily.
Erica walked with him to the front entrance, passing the incident room. DCI Sparks was by the whiteboards briefing the team. Moss and Peterson looked up and saw Erica being escorted out. They looked away.
Airbrushed out, said Erica under her breath.
They reached the front desk where Wolf asked her to hand over her car keys.
Now?
Sorry, yes.
Come on, Wolf, how do I get home?
I can arrange for one of the uniformed officers to run you home.
Run me home? Fuck that, said Erica.
She put her car keys on the counter and walked out of Lewisham Row station. Outside on the street, Erica searched for a bus stop or taxi, but there was nothing in sight on the busy ring road. She set off for Lewisham station, checking in her bag for loose change, but all she had was her credit cards.
She was searching through the old tissues and rubbish in the deep pockets of her leather jacket when her hand felt something small, square and rigid. She pulled out a little white envelope.
It was thick and looked expensive. There was nothing written on the front. She turned it over and pushed her finger under the flap, opening it. Nestling inside was 1 sheet of folded paper. She stopped dead in the street, the cars rushing by. It was a printout of a newspaper article about the raid where Mark and 4 of her colleagues had lost their lives. There was a photo of the path leading up to the house in Rochdale where dead bodies lay covered, surrounded by pools of blood and broken glass. Another of police helicopters hovering above the house, airlifting 2 of her colleagues who would later die in hospital. And there was a grainy black and white picture of a barely recognisable officer lying on a stretcher and soaked in blood, his hand raised with limp fingers. It was the last photo taken of Mark alive.
Above it was written in red marker pen,
You're just like me, DCI Foster. We've both killed 5. Chapter 33. Over the next few days, there was a shift in the media coverage of Andrea's murder, and Erica's statement at the press appeal kindled a more negative press reaction. It smoked at first, with hints of Andrea's past relationships, then slowly sputtered to life with fiery revelations of Andrea's many lovers, and the suggestion that she'd enjoyed both male and female partners. By the end of the week, the tabloids ignited in a fireball of disclosures. One of Andrea's ex-boyfriends, who described himself as performance artist, came forward and sold his story to one of the tabloids. Stills from a video emerged of them engaging in oral and anal sex, and of Andrea being tied up and flogged in a sex dungeon while wearing a see-through plastic dress and a gag ball. The tabloids had prudishly pixelated the images, but readers could be in no doubt as to what she was doing. The broadsheets condemned the tabloids while simultaneously offering their own thoughts and opinions, stoking the fire. The right-leaning newspapers had found a new way to attack Simon Douglas Brown, and in their eyes, Andrea might, just might, have asked for it. Erica passed four long and lonely few days in her new flat, attempting to settle in. She got her electricity sorted out and watched the media coverage unfold. She went for a medical check-up, taking the bus to Lewisham Hospital, where she explained she was a police officer and she had been exposed to blood and bodily fluids. Samples of her blood and urine were taken, and she was told she would have to return for a further blood test in 3 months' time. The whole encounter was cold and clinical, and made her feel very small and insignificant in the world. Alone in her flat, she kept staring at the note, trying to work out how it had been placed in her pocket. Was she losing it? How could she have not noticed something? Her mind went back over the days leading up to finding it, over all the places she had been. But it could have been anyone, anywhere. For now, she kept it in a clear plastic evidence bag. She knew she should hand it in, but something in the back of her mind told her to keep hold of it. On the fifth morning, Erica arrived at the newsagent opposite Brockley Station to buy the day's papers when she saw the front page headline of the Daily Mail, "Top Cop Suspended from Andrea Case." It detailed how, after a series of high-profile mistakes and blunders running the Andrea Douglas Brown murder inquiry, DCI Erica Foster had been suspended from duty pending a full inquiry. It stated that Foster had been accused of erratic behaviour, of leaking information to the press relating to the case, and of misplacing confidential information regarding police informants, which most probably resulted in the death of Ivy Norris. There was a photo taken of Erica through the passenger window of a car. Her eyes were wide and mouth gurning as she reached out for the dashboard. Under the photo, the caption read, "Blundering Cop Erica Foster." The photo had been taken by the press outside the Horniman Museum crime scene, where Moss's car had slipped on the ice. Erica threw the newspaper down and left without buying anything. When she got back home, she made a strong coffee and switched on the television.
The BBC News Channel counted down to the hourly headlines,
and then Andrea Douglas Brown's face appeared on the screen with the announcement that the police had arrested a man called Marco Frost in connection with her murder. The report flicked back to the newsreader. 28-year-old Marco Frost was originally eliminated from police inquiries, but was subsequently found to have lied about being abroad when Andrea Douglas Brown was murdered. The footage then showed Marco, a handsome, dark-haired young man, emerging handcuffed from the entrance to a block of flats. He had his head down and was led away by two uniformed officers to a police car. They held the back of his head as he was loaded in, and then the car sped away. The camera cut to Simon Douglas Brown and Giles Osborne, standing with Marsh outside the revolving Scotland Yard sign. "This morning, police raided the home of Marco Frost and discovered material of a disturbing nature related to the victim. It is believed the suspect had developed an unhealthy obsession with Andrea Douglas Brown in the months leading up to her abduction and murder," said Marsh. Simon then stood forward, his face pained, his hands twitching in his suit jacket pockets. "I would like to thank the Metropolitan Police for their diligence and continued efforts
in what has been a problematic investigation. I would like to say that I have full confidence in the new investigative team, and I thank them.